Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. I'm Carola Böhm.
And I'm Rich McCarthy. And we're both European.
Still.
Yes, at the moment.
Right.
So I'm in danger of not being European for too much longer.
So we're on the last chapter of the Charter.
And the last chapter is Chapter 7, General Provisions.
Right, which is a bit of a difficult one, isn't it? Because it doesn't have specific rights. It's rather what they call transversal articles that talk about the applicability and the scope
of the Charter itself,
yeah,
basically. So it shouldn't take too long, I think.
And then we can have a chat about what is our hopes and visions for the European Union over the next 5 years. The European Parliament, of course, having just confirmed their new president of the Commission.
Yes.
Right. Article 51.
So Article 51, scope. The provisions of this Charter are addressed to the institutions and bodies of the Union with due regard for the principle of subsidiarity and to the Member States only when they are implementing Union law. They shall therefore respect the rights, observe the principles, and promote the application thereof in accordance with their respective powers. So that's when it talks about the institutions and bodies of the Union, we're thinking people like the European Court of Justice, the Central Bank, that sort of thing. The Central Bank, I should think it has lots of things to do with human rights in terms of their lending money to people and organisations, and so they've got to be careful about who they lend that money to.
Maybe. You would hope. Well, it just shows it's another area where we actually
don't know anything.
Yes, exactly. We just hope that the European Bank does the right thing. But do we actually know if they...
We don't know, so yes. That'd be the next thing that we should... Well, not necessarily. Banks might be boring, but they sort of brought the whole world to a disastrously close to an end of civilization as we know it about 10 years ago, didn't they?
Yeah.
We've just seen something recently that says it's not the banks necessarily who did it, but the
legislators allowed the banks to
act stupidly enough, yeah, to do it.
Right, but we've digressed a bit. So the scope, so Article 51 is called scope.
Mm-hmm.
It just suggests that...
Okay, we've read it already, but...
No, we haven't.
We have.
No, just...
I read it through. That's why we talked about this.
Oh, have we already talked
yes,
about this?
We have been talking about it.
I don't remember that. I thought we digressed before even we started.
No, but that's what I mentioned. I said, oh, the member states, the institutions and bodies, like the European Court of Justice and the Central Bank. And
you know, it's glad that we recorded it. I can remind myself to
absolutely
to
great. It's good that it's
podcast.
Not live.
This is, yeah, exactly. That's why we're doing it, because it's not live.
Yeah. We wouldn't do anything live.
Right, okay, so the second section.
So, paragraph 2. This charter does not establish any new power or task for the community or the union, or modify powers and tasks defined by the treaties.
Yeah.
So nothing new has been created by this charter. That's yeah, basically what it's saying.
And of course, that was slightly confusing for us at the start of, you know, is this the legislative underpinning or not? But my feeling is that back when it was created, it was supposed to be aspirational. And I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I'm not an EU expert or a historian, but it just feels like because it was part of the constitution, the failed constitution of the European Union project. And of course, if it had been integrated in the constitution, then it would have been law. So there was a attempt to make this the basic law, but because the constitution project failed, there weren't enough leaders of the nation states to support that. That's why we're in this limbo. That's my interpretation of it, that this is a clarification of EU law and it only applies where EU law exists.
Mm. And all the things that are mentioned in here as rights, and then we read through stuff and it turns out they're only principles. When you read the word right in this charter at the moment, you have to take it with a pinch of salt.
Yes, and if you read Article 52, the second sentence, rights recognised by this charter which are based on the community treaties or the Treaty on European Union shall be exercised under the conditions and within the limits defined by those treaties. So it does go back to the treaties again.
Right, okay. So that's under scope of guaranteed rights, which is Article 52. 52, the scope of the guaranteed rights. So Article 52 says that the rights written down in here only apply to European things and don't apply if there's no if there's nothing governing those things on in community treaties or the Treaty of the European Union. And then
and it suggests that European law might also be more extensive than this charter. That's the last sentence, isn't it?
Right. So it's basically saying that union law can still progress. It doesn't have to be limited by this charter.
Yeah. I found a handbook from last year, from 2018, which is a guidance document on how to apply the charter in law and policymaking at national level. For legislators to apply the charter, the the flow chart is almost like, first of all, they consider their national law if that is conformed to EU law. And if it implements EU law, then the charter applies. If it doesn't implement union law, then the charter does not apply and it can go back to national law. That's how I understand it. And, you know, there's a sort of explicit making that these human rights apply foremost at national and local level. And it is there that rights make a real difference.
Right. So it's a shame they didn't put out the flowchart when they did the charter at the same time, like incorporate it into the charter.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's again, you know, that's why it's a project under construction, isn't it? As we said last time, EU law is typically implemented at national level. The obligation under the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights are thus of particular relevance to national policymakers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, you know, the next two articles are almost like a get-out clause if the application of charter articles provide unintended consequences. So nothing in this charter shall be interpreted as restricting or adversely affecting human rights and fundamental freedoms as recognized in their respective fields of application by union law and international law and by international agreements to which the union, the community, or all member states are party, including the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms and by the member states' constitutions. It must have been a German writing this.
Why?
It's an ultra-long sentence, actually.
As we had said, that nothing in the Charter is going to affect other things, other rights that people have and that we've signed up to. And if we've made a mistake in putting together this, it doesn't mean that that will preclude you from other rights. And Article 54, Prohibition of Abuse of Rights, this Charter doesn't give you the ability to abuse other rights that are available elsewhere as a result.
Yeah. And that's the charter.
That is the charter.
So I think we know much more about the charter than we did before we started this.
Yeah, sort of. I don't feel confident about it, but yes.
But we would know which questions to ask now.
Well, we know where the document is to go back and think about. And with a little boning up, we could feel that we'd know which questions to ask. That's what I think. Whereas before it would just been, never seen the charter of Fundamental Human Rights of the European Union. I still can't remember the title of this, so even though we've been doing it for several weeks now.
Oh, I can test you now. So what's the title without looking at your document?
Well, I've just read it, so it's the Charter of Fundamental Human Rights of the European Union.
Oh, wrong. Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union.
Okay.
Okay, what is the first sentence? You know, the lovely sentence that we wanted to put music to?
But we never did, so no, I don't know what the first sentence is.
The peoples of Europe, in creating an ever closer union among them, are resolved to share a peaceful future based on common values.
Okay. Well, we ought to have it written above a door or something like that.
Well, I think it might be a bit nerdy.
Well, it means you get to learn it, doesn't it?
Okay.
Right. We could have it written above our door, but instead of the peoples of Europe, we could just put the people living here or something like that.
Yeah, as we said, we're doing just the same. An ever closer union.
Oh, right.
And we resolve to share
people peaceful. Living here in creating an ever closer union among them, except I think Sun would argue about that. He'd be probably wanting to get an ever closer and ever further apart union.
Yes.
I resolve to share a peaceful future based on common values.
Right. I would love to for us to also just chat about, you know, having done this, having gone through the charter.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we know that just this last week, Ursula von der Leyen was confirmed by Parliament, by the European Parliament,
yeah,
to become the next president of the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for the next 5 years. So what are our hopes and visions for the European Union for the next 5 years? You know, what would we like them to do?
Well, I think because we disagree about Ursula von der Leyen, don't we? No. So we were all naive and simplistic in our discussion about her last week, and now we recognise that there are problems. Certainly I do. I think for you, it's the fact that she's a woman makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think there are also some other things. So we know, of course, that the Greens and the Green contingent has suggested, yeah, you know, there are two positives about Ursula von der Leyen and there are two negatives, and that made her not able to confirm her vote. So the Greens voted actually against her. And of course, as we know, the margin wasn't quite as big. She was confirmed by two handfuls of votes. So Molly Scott-Carto, one of the Green MEPs, suggested, yeah, brilliant that it's the first woman president. Brilliant that she's willing to grant the UK a further Brexit extension. Of course, that was quite important. And she's been already in the news confirming that she's a Remainer. She openly said, we want the UK to be in the European Union. So it's up to the UK to do whatever they need to do.
Which it seems virtually everybody in the European Union does want.
Mm. But that's not keeping them in against their will, which the Brexiteers are trying to make out. But anyway,
they hope that we will decide to remain.
Then the two negative aspects that, of course, her choice was not according to the agreed Spitzenkandidat system. So the Greens suggest that this is a backroom deal cobbled together to appease the far right. So that's their interpretation of that. And then the last one is that it doesn't support sufficiently the Green agenda for the radical change that we might need to just simply exist.
When you say it, I mean, it is such a huge thing.
It is
the agenda we might need to simply exist. So
yeah, and I think that's where our opinions part, because for me, as we said before, the centre-right representatives in Europe, and specifically in Germany, tend to be more left than other centre-right candidates. You know, I think we could have done much worse. And I think she has already promised some things that, from my perspective, go towards what we've actually discussed before. So she pledged to establish an EU-wide minimum wage, which is a big thing. And of course, you know, our Conservatives are dead against that. But I think that's something very positive and very progressive. She's pledged to prop up national welfare systems in the case of an economic crisis, and ensure flexibility in the tax and spend restraints on Eurozone countries. She committed to what she says, far-reaching environmental program, including a Green Deal, and also committed to a new EU carbon border tax with the aim of achieving carbon neutrality on the continent by 2050. Now, you know, as we said, is that enough or not? I'm just wondering if she's probably the best candidate that we could hope for.
Well, maybe, but, you know, things like the minimum wage. Minimum wages can be a bad thing as well as being a good thing, because if you set the minimum wage very low, then everybody drops their pay to the minimum wage instead of using it to increase people's pay. So, you know, there's no indication particularly about the minimum wage. Hopefully it would be a minimum wage doing what it's supposed to do, but we don't know that. You know, she said that increasing the commitment to reduce carbon by... So at the moment, the EU is set to reduce carbon emissions by 40% by 2030, and she said that she'd commit herself to 50%. So we said, that's not very good, because, you know, they're thinking commit to drop to 50% by 2030 with the eye to dropping to zero by 2050. But as far as we understand, we need to do a lot more than that in order to prevent global warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Mm.
And after that, it starts getting a bit tricky about whether global warming might become runaway and something that we cannot control at all. So, you know, it's another sort of let's do less at the moment and then try and do lots more later on and hope that science will come up with a way out of it and things like that, which is what we've been doing for the last 20 or 30 years.
But isn't that, you know, partially that's also the problem of democracy, that you have to take people with you. And at the point where she did those speeches, which were, yes, rightly criticized as being neither here and there, in some ways, the only thing you can do is be a bit more ambiguous. And now, of course, it's going to be interesting. Okay, so what is she going to do now? Now, she will need the Green faction to get European, you know, policies that are about the environment to go through. So, you know, the one of the positive aspects of not having such a big majority is that she does need to work with other factions in the European Parliament and in the European Council.
And clearly, she doesn't really need to work with the Greens about that. The Greens are for anything pushing better environmental standards. But she also needs to work with the other people.
Yeah.
But she's not got any pressure to bear on them because she hasn't promised anything. She can't say, I've got to do so and such, I've got to do this, I've got to do the other, because she hasn't promised that, you know. So therefore, she hasn't made a commitment, so she doesn't have to go with any commitment.
Yeah. Do you just think that the pledges are relatively weak? I guess my opinion would be that the pledges express something which at this point can only, you know, that's the limit of what you can express at this point in the political process.
Yeah, but I think that's the idea of, well, we can push it a little bit more, we can push it a little bit more. We'll keep things as they are, but we'll try and tweak at the edges and we'll get a bit further. And that's not what we need. What we need is a complete change.
Yeah.
You know, we are trying to push for zero emissions by 2030 in the UK, and that's going to be a lot harder if Europe is not pushing to zero emissions or is only pushing to 50% drop in emissions.
Whether we're in or out in
both
cases.
Whether we're in or out, yeah.
Yeah. So what do we want from the EU over the next 5 years?
Well, we want it to reduce carbon emissions to zero by 2030. Clearly, we're not going to get that, are we? So unfortunately, our hopes are dashed.
Yeah, and it's not about reducing what we do in the economy. It's shifting that to renewable energies. And of course, you know, it is absolutely possible. You know, we could just simply shift the jobs which are coal-based to jobs that are renewables-based.
So we need to remove any kind of subsidies for carbon materials, for carbon production, you know, digging up coal, producing gas and oil, all of that sort of thing. So all of those subsidies need to go.
Yeah. Okay, so
that would be, obviously, that would be a big thing.
Yeah, so big priority for us is environment, and that infiltrates all other aspects as well. As we said, a common agricultural policy.
Because that hugely affects the environment too.
Exactly. I would like Brexit to go away and the European Union to help with that.
Yes, but they can't really.
And, you know, I know it's a sensitive issue, but I'm not sure if they shouldn't intervene. You know, the referendum was corrupt.
It was,
interfered with.
It won't allow people who are European Union citizens and have been working here for decades, earning money for our benefit, for the benefit of Britain.
The media is biased. And, you know, even if you look at what's happening now, Boris Johnson is suggesting to prorogue Parliament, which actually should be say is a coup. It's against democratic principle.
Yeah.
It's an executive coup.
Yeah. Talk about anti-democratic.
At what point do you say, as a neighbouring country, you need to adhere to democratic principles that you've subscribed to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
At what point does that happen?
People assume that members of the Conservative Party support the same democracy that the rest of us do. And that's the problem with us not having a written down
constitution.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well,
if Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt or whoever is Prime Minister should go to the Queen and say, we would like to suspend Parliament, then it's, does she say, what? You've got to be kidding me. Suspend Parliament? No, that's not what I want for my
subjects.
That's not how to run a Parliament. Go away and come up with a different solution, which I would hope that she would do. Because some people would say, but he's the Prime Minister. He's gone to her. Why isn't she following what the Prime Minister says? And we would say, because that Prime Minister was only elected by 0.25% of the population, and he's not standing actually for the majority of people in Britain. That's why she should say that. Or she goes along with what the Prime Minister says because he's the Prime Minister.
Wow.
And then she acts against the will of huge numbers of the people.
I know. Just imagine, maybe it's in the end the Queen who saves us in this mess.
Absolutely. You know the Love Actually moment where in the Hugh Grant Prime Minister has a nasty jibe at the American president? Maybe the Queen will come out being the Hugh Grant character who says, bog off, Prime Minister, we're not going to do that.
Yeah,
should it come to it? I hope so. That would be brilliant.
Yeah, that would be lovely. So that's what we want from the European Union?
There's more.
You want more?
Yeah, definitely. A big thing about the European Union, we've got to have a good policy on immigration. We're going to have huge numbers of people wanting to immigrate into the European Union. Why? Because we're killing their environment. So there's going to be loads of people coming. There have been loads of people coming from Africa. There are going to be more. Why is that? It's because, largely, as far as I understand, it's because we like flying aeroplanes. So because we like flying aeroplanes, it causes this thing called global dimming, which means that the sunlight hitting the northern hemisphere is reduced by jet trails and so on. That means that the sunshine not hitting the ground means that water isn't evaporated to become cloud, which would then go over Africa and would then rain and make Africa a fertile land which could support people by growing food, etc. So our over-abuse of using aeroplane travel is causing famine and drought in Africa and has been for decades. And, you know, that and our sucking resources out of Africa anyway, when European nations were vying over Africa and wanting bits of it and chopping it up into pieces and so on and so on, all of that means that Africa is largely a much tougher continent to live on than it would have been otherwise. So we should say, okay, if you don't want to live in Africa because you're starving to death and your family's starving to death and your family's being persecuted by some local warlord or something like that, yeah, of course you can come into the European Union because it's largely our fault that all these things have happened. So yes, and we need a proper way of supporting these people as they come across the border, when they're at the border, and working out whether they're refugees or whatever. And if they're here to earn money, why shouldn't they be here to earn money, for goodness sake?
And I still think open borders is the answer, because people don't come here if they can avoid it. You know, people don't leave their homes if they can avoid it in general.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to go back, you know, to address the issues at home, but also to have open borders, and you're absolutely right, consider immigration policy not to be at the point where the boundaries are, but immigration policy to be at every stage of their journey. So what happens in the home countries of those individuals who set off? What happens on the journey? And so it's a whole suite of policies that looks at the whole chain that produces immigration.
Yeah.
Right. So immigration is something that...
Immigration is a big thing. And I think it's going to make the difference between a world where everything is where we get on with each other and we're quite happy with each other. We can argue and we can chat and talk and argue vociferously about stuff, or whether we're some kind of armed state who polices everything left, right and center, shoots people on sight because we're not sure about them, you know. Which way are we going to go?
There's a term that is now being thrown about, which is called climate apartheid.
Yeah. Well, we're applying it already, aren't we?
Well, exactly. Which way are we going to react to the climate emergency? Are we going to wall off our borders and try to hide behind a relatively safe, environmentally contained nation state, hoping that we can delay the destruction of the environment a bit longer? Or are we going to be part of the solution?
Mm.
And if we think we can contain immigration, if we think the numbers are a problem now, it will be 50 times more people from the south heading north if we don't get the climate under control.
Absolutely.
So we've got environment, we've got common agricultural policy, we've got Brexit, we've got immigration.
And I suppose a big thing is rights. Rights of people, not labour, but people.
To finish the European project, to include fairness and civil rights, social rights to individuals on a fair basis, on an equal basis,
across throughout the European Union. And I think when we say finish the European project, I think for many people in the UK, the idea of a federation of the European Union is a thing too far. But if we think about the idea of giving across the European Union everybody having the same kind of rights, then suddenly, once we've done that, then suddenly the Federation of the European Union doesn't matter. Because if you've got the same, if everybody has the same rights, then nobody can argue, oh, they're coming to Britain to get this or that or the other, because they could get it where they are.
But the strange thing is, why is it that for so many individuals, thinking about the former Commonwealth is a positive thought, and thinking about a federated Europe is a negative thought?
Because we've just glossed over the history and said, oh, we got on really well with places and people in India liked us because we brought the rule of law and all that sort of
stuff. So it's simply because we're not at the center of the European project. We don't like it. The Brexiteers.
Yeah, because they're not in control of it. Mm. Because it's not doing what they want it to do. I think a lot of Brexiteers come from a background where they expect things to be done the way they want it to be done because they've come from privilege. And then they've convinced an awful lot of people who are not privileged at all, who have been faced with exactly that thing, making their lives a misery, and then they're being told that it's not, that what makes their life a misery is the European Union.
And I think that's what we see, you know, the key there is this notion of privilege, that we have to acknowledge that because we have a divided society with very few highly privileged individuals, that our political leaders are so inept because they lived in that privileged bubble.
Mm.
And, you know, whenever I see European politicians, you know, specifically in relation to the Brexit negotiations, and then UK politicians, I think one of the biggest problems is that we didn't attend to the de-stratification of our society. We still have private schools. We still have the Oxbridge contingent that has corporate and political leaders in a disproportionate manner. And then we see people like Boris Johnson, where you think, how did he get to the point where he is? Well, he got to the point where he is because privilege in this society is quite often enough and replaces intellect or common sense or political sense.
Mm.
Right. So there you have our five wishes for the European Union. Environment, immigration, Brexit, civil rights for individuals, common agricultural policy.
Oh, tax, we haven't mentioned.
Ooh.
You know, correct taxation would be phenomenal.
Okay. We'll leave it as that.
Okay. So now the work is on for you to try and cut this together. Make it into a decent podcast, because it's been very long as well. Okay, that's the end of this podcast. That's the end of our examination of the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union. And now I can go and put my feet up. Well, Carola struggles womanfully to put all this together as a podcast.
Also, feel free to follow us on Twitter. We've got a Twitter feed on @DithringE. Goodbye for now.
Bye. Goodbye.
And have a fabulous week. So, to address the global...
climate change crisis.
Okay, to address the global... Sorry, to... to address the global change crisis. Sorry. To
global
address the
climate
global
change crisis.
Why am I? Global climate change crisis?
Yeah.
To address the global climate change crisis? But there was
no,
a sixth
I've run
one.
Out of fingers.
No, there was a sixth one.
You
I
combined
one.
Two, social and civil.
No, I didn't. Ugh, gosh, we'll replay it. And those are the five.
Okay.